Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. When an independent expert panel concluded earlier this week that Peter Bone MP had committed various acts of bullying and one act of sexual misconduct against a member of his staff, the scene was set not just for much of Westminster's navel-gazing about whether or not this could lead to another difficult by-election for the Conservatives, but for renewed calls to overhaul the culture of harassment and misogyny in Parliament. But we have been here before, so many times before. Is this just the latest in a long, lurid line of incidents? And why is nothing changing? Or are we looking at this through the wrong end of the telescope, with so many more women in Parliament, which has led to legislation about the menopause and childcare? Does that mean that change can happen? Should we be more positive? To help me explore women in Westminster, I'm delighted to welcome to my couch Rachel Johnson, host of a Sunday show on LBC and host of the Difficult Women podcast, amongst other things. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Lucy. Very nice to join you to talk about women in Westminster. I feel so lucky that I only worked actually in Westminster briefly, but that was in the very early 90s, and it was kind of the bear pit then, very few women. And anyway, yeah, so but I got out quite quickly.
But of course, you were the first female graduate trainee at the FT. So what was that culture like when you got to the bear pit of Westminster? Did you sort of think, oh, actually, I know this. This is how the world works?
Well, I think I'm not a brilliant person to be one of those women who says, you know, I was fighting off men and, you know, I was being groped in the stranger's bar and all of these things, because it's perfectly possible that I have simply gone into a total state of denial. But I joined the FT when I was, you know, straight out of university. There were very few women on the paper, but it was very much like a senior common room atmosphere. You know, I'm not saying that nothing goes awry in a senior common room, but I mean, the people there were sort of fellows of All Souls. They were kind of foreign policy experts. They were reporters. Because I was the first female graduate trainee, I was treated with kid gloves rather than like, you know, the girl who should run out of the meeting and make the coffee. You know, I wasn't kind of fast tracked into good jobs or anything. I mean, I remember at one point, after I'd been there a couple of years, I discovered that the male graduate trainee had been put on a higher salary level than I had. And they were done exactly the same thing. And I thought, this is ridiculous. And I marched into the managing editor's office and I said, why is John, because that was his name, being put up by a couple of grand and I haven't? And he said, you're right, that's an error. And I was moved up, but they moved him up automatically.
And whereas you had to fight for it.
I had to go and ask. And it was when I was on the FT that I was also working in Westminster as a press gallery reporter and covering you know, parliamentary committees and doing a bit of political reporting. So I didn't have a lobby pass, but I was working in the palace and I was working, you know, in the FT's office in the kind of, not the bowels, in the kind of, you know, some far off carpeted room. And again, I can't remember any kind of, you know, funky behaviour. Although if I'd hung around and gone to the bars after work, I think I was probably pregnant with my first child or something, and I was just desperate to get home and rest. I think it could have happened.
And this is what people are saying, is that actually it is because there is this strong drinking culture, there's a big power imbalance, that actually there are quite a lot of rumours about who you shouldn't perhaps be in a bar with late at night, get in a taxi with. And certainly in investment banking, that was a culture that I was exposed to, and you, as a woman, you navigated your way around that. But do you think Westminster, given the nature of, you know, the decisions that are made, it's so demanding, it's a work hard, play hard culture, Do you think that explains what happens in Westminster? Or do you think it is, in fact, from what you've observed, a toxic workplace?
Well, I've talked to lots of women who've been lobby journalists and worked in Westminster in the way I haven't. And they all say that you've got to be careful. The hand goes up your skirt. Even one who I work with, who launched my podcast for Global, went off and became a political journalist. And she said it happened to her immediately. And I sort of can't, I can't really believe it, that it still goes on in the way it does. And how can men be so stupid as to think that they're going to get away with it still? I mean, which just brings us to, I suppose, to Peter Bone. What you realise about these instances is it's never the first time.
Yeah.
When a man is finally caught or reported or suspended, which could lead to a recall election and a by-election, you realise that this could be the 100th time they've done it. And I think the way they get away with it, you know, in a kind of psychological term, the way of the human interaction with that other person, the woman has to say to herself, he only did it to me because I'm special. And it's an additional insult, really, when you realise that you're just another one of his long line of people he's done it to. So in a sense, women are abused twice when it happens to them, because they realise it wasn't because they were special. It was simply because they were female that it happened.
Although actually, of course, what we really ought to emphasise is that sexual orientation, particularly in Westminster, is no barrier to this kind of sexual harassment, because my sense is that there are, you know, many young gay men, some of whom may be very comfortable with their sexuality, but some of them may not be sure about it just yet because they're that young, you know, starting out in their first job. And they're being exploited by male MPs who are also not sure. Well, actually, no, they're either not sure about their sexuality, or they are indeed very sure, but they're not very transparent about it. You know, they've got the wife and they've got the children as a cover. So I think maybe Westminster also has a lot of vulnerable people. For many, you know, it might be the first family setup that they've ever had. So maybe that also contributes to the way in which the power is abused.
I agree totally. And I think that we saw in Chris Bryant's autobiography, where he actually set out the number of times that, in theory, married or heterosexual male MPs had made unwanted or approaches or even sexual assaults to him in Parliament on the estate. Which bears out what you say, that these men are hidden, they're doing it in plain sight, which shows they're acting in secret, which just adds another layer of toxicity when these men are closeted and also, you know, assaulting, if that's the right word, other men or even their juniors, because of course then you have the power. It's usually the young political researchers, the special advisors, who are prey. What was interesting about Chris Bryant was he said that he was touched up by fellow MPs who were in theory not even gay.
That's right. And it's that secrecy, the subterfuge of it, that I think contributes to the toxicity, because you've got the subterfuge of the actual behaviour, and then you've got this very tricky situation of how do I deal with this? Who can I speak to anonymously, when in fact I'm in many cases being employed by this person? You know, there is sort of strange way that MPs employ their team. You're all like, it's like over 600 small businesses in a way within Westminster, as opposed to people being employed by the Houses of Parliament. So you've got the subterfuge of the behaviour, but also the where do we go to keep this, to keep my complaint secret, so that I'm not going to be, so that my career isn't jeopardized, or my, you know, or worse, so that I'm not harassed for trying to blow the whistle. Is that part of the problem?
I remember when I did an hour on this, I remember them somebody saying the only person you can report this to is the person who's done it.
Yeah.
I mean, that you're working for that MP. And I think there is an idea now that the Commons or Palace is going to, Westminster is going to have some sort of HR department where you can go and talk to somebody who's not you're somebody you're working directly for and have it sorted out. But again, you know, how is that going to work if you want to carry on working for that MP, but you just want them to start behaving properly?
Like a grown up.
And yeah. Yeah. It's also a very boisy environment. It's like a kind of overgrown, overexcited public school. That's what it felt like when I was working there.
Yes.
You know, with alcohol sloshing through everybody's veins.
And I think that that culture is really important to recognise, because not every workplace has that freedom, really. I mean, you've edited a magazine, for example, so you've been in charge of a whole team of people within a publishing organization. You've written novels, you're steeped in different industries, really. As a journalist, you've worked for different papers and magazines. Given all of that experience of people management, so to speak, what would you do? How would you change it? Is it just about creating an HR department?
I don't know, because I think you've got to change in a whole culture about who wants to become MPs, who selects your MPs, and then who controls the MPs or manages the MPs. And at every stage, there are probably mistakes in the selection process. And, you know, Isabel Harman wrote about why we get the wrong politicians. It's all to do with constituents. You know, in the Tory party, they don't have A-lists. In the Labour party, they do, which I think is in all-female shortlists. Tory party has A-lists where they pipeline preferred candidates rather than gender diverse or equality. It's not a diversity of candidates, but a kind of the opposite of a diversity of candidates. They prioritise the sort of person they think looks and sounds and feels like a Tory MP. And I think in the last round of selections for the next general election, lots of MPs are standing down, they're reselecting. I think it's supposedly the least diverse group of perspectives have been selected. Mm-hmm. To fight the GE in 2024/25 than ever. I mean, very few women from what I've been hearing. So if they're not selecting women, women aren't going to put themselves forward. And therefore, the whole culture of male superiority and entitlement is going to be perpetuated.
And that's going to have repercussions actually more widely, because one of the things that has been very encouraging over the last few years is to see what can only really be described as female-oriented legislation being put up for debate. So you've had women championing legislation for the menopause, women like my local MP, Nikki Akin, championing legislation to get paid people to have paid leave when they're having IVF treatment, which is, yeah, you know, a very demanding and physically and emotionally grueling experience. You know, one would like to think that the presence of women has made that happen, because maybe I'm just being very black and white about it. I just can't see that very many men would have woken up one morning as an MP, even if they're married to a woman, thinking my next policy needs to be about IVF treatment or...
Yeah, I'm just Googling now. I mean, I think it was Barbara Castle who brought in the Equal Pay Act in 1970. I mean, it's all very well for, you know, women parliamentarians like brilliant Barbara Castle to bring in legislation that's going to help women live and work with the same advantages and disadvantages as men, you know, to help level the playing field. But the truth is that however many years it's been since 53 years since the Equal Pay Act, we still haven't had equal pay. So you could introduce legislation for IVF, you can introduce legislation about paternity leave or shared parental leave, but it doesn't mean that the country takes advantage of the legislation, because that we're not living in a kind of Nordic, Scandi culture whereby it's absolutely expected that, you know, the man will take his leave, his entitlement. The percentage of men who actually take paternity leave is something like 7%.
That's right.
When you've got when you've got that statistic, you know that the absolute bulk of childcare and domestic responsibility, not just for children, but for parents and teenagers and, you know, children in your 20s, you know, you never stop being a mother. You just end up caring for more people as you get older. You care for your aged parents, and then you care for your grandchildren as well as your children.
So ultimately, and I suppose finally, what I, you know, it could be about trust. It could be about trust within the workplace, that people who enter Parliament know that they've got a safe working environment. And let's be clear, the majority of MPs are not harassing their fellow staff members. They're not trying to abuse their power. But if, as you say, you know, fewer women are actually going in to, and the research more widely shows that women have a tendency to hold back when it comes to putting themselves forward for career change and promotion, because they fear that they don't tick all the boxes.
Yeah.
Whereas a man will think, oh, well, I've only got five of those elements on my CV, but I'm going to go for it anyway. But actually, if women are saying, I can't see what's in it for me, and when I work there, it's going to be an absolute nightmare, a sort of sexual harassment minefield. What do you think could be done to actually shift that? Is it about Westminster, or actually is this something that needs to change beyond the walls of Westminster? A more societal shift? Are we still lagging behind, despite Me Too and the shift that brought about, the ripple effect that had within Westminster? Are we actually just too far away from actually this stopping?
Well, I mean, I think it's still a problem in Westminster. I think it's a problem in the city. I don't think it's a problem in the media. I mean, I think my industry, you know, across broadcast and print media has got brilliant women editors at last, and plenty of them. I mean, I do think it's just a question of getting more women at the top. You know, 30% of women on every board. I mean, it shouldn't be a huge ask. 30% of women in Parliament. I mean, we've got a lower, we did until the Afghan women MPs were all exiled. You know, our rate of female representation is lower than places like Kazakhstan and Afghanistan. You know, it is pitiful. Women have got to be sought out. I mean, there are all these, you know, groups which you say, you know, tell a friend to stand for Parliament and Women to Win. And I, you know, I think they're all a good thing, but I think it's about encouraging women to want to be parliamentarians. At the moment, I have to say, you know, having lived through politics at quite a close range and seen the horrific amount of personal and abuse you get abuse in the press, anyone who sticks their head above the parapet, anybody even tweets, is seen as fair game. I can see why women just think, why would I do that? And so, in a sense, what I'm saying is, we've got to change the whole tone of social media. We've got to change the way newspapers write about women completely. So it's not about their appearance or whether they've got children or whether they've said, you know, any of those things. It's about treating women exactly the same way that they treat men, and they just don't.
And yes, that, if a woman that's goes parity. On television,
if a woman goes on television, people talk about her appearance. If a man goes on television, they listen to what they say. It's still a very, very long, steep road ahead.
Well, on that note, let's hope that the next time we speak, we'll have a little more good news to talk about in terms of women in Westminster. But for now, Rachel Johnson, thank you very much for being my guest on The Couch.
Thank you, Lucy.